Hello, my name is Dawn, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Midwest Regional Teleconference. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. I will now turn the call over to Heather Donovan. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name is Heather Donegan, and I am from the Indiana State Chapter of the National MS Society. On behalf of the Society, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program titled Progressive MS. This program is brought to you through a collaboration of the Greater Illinois, Gateway Area, Indiana, and Mid-America chapters. Together, we provide programs, services, and research to improve the lives of people affected by MS. Recordings of this call will be available through each chapter's lending library for anyone wishing to refresh their notes or share with a friend. We would also like to mention there is a wealth of opportunity made available by the Society through your local chapter for all levels of participation. We encourage you to reach out to your local chapter by calling 1-800-344-4867 or by visiting their website for a list of upcoming events and programs. We would also like to take a moment to thank our program sponsors, Bayer Healthcare and Biogen IDEC, for supporting portions of this series. Please note that during the first part of the program, during our speaker's presentation, you will be in listen mode. Feel free to jot your comments and questions down as you listen. Following the presentation, the operator will open the lines for anyone to ask their questions. We ask all participants with questions to limit their time to one question per request so that as many participants as possible may enjoy a direct response from our speaker. We are fortunate tonight to have as our speaker, Dorothy Northrup. Dorothy Northrup serves as Vice President of Research and Clinical Operations for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society and coordinates society initiatives to expand long-term care options for people with MS. Her responsibilities include resource development, representation of the Society in the national long-term care arena, educational presentations both within and outside the Society, publication of relevant books and periodicals, and staff training and consultation. Her Society publications include a series of guideline and recommendation documents to promote quality care for people with MS across the continuum of long-term care services, as well as a publication for caregivers titled Caring for Loved Ones with Advanced MS, A Guide for Families. Prior to joining the Home Office in 2000, Dorothy served as Director of Chapter Services for the Greater North Jersey Chapter of the Society for over 5 years. A licensed social worker in the state of New Jersey, Dorothy received her BA in Sociology from the University of Massachusetts and her Master's degree in Social Work from Columbia University in New York City. And now, I would like to welcome Dorothy Northrup to begin this evening's program.
Well, thank you, Heather, and I'm so glad to be able to be part of this teleconference tonight. I think that many of you have received the outline of what I hope to kind of cover during my time with you. What we're going to be talking about, of course, as Heather mentioned, and I'm sure you know, is progressive MS. And I thought what we'd do tonight is kind of look, first of all, at what is it, and perhaps talking a little bit about clinically managing the disease. Then we'll talk a little bit about the emotional and family issues, which certainly come with progressive MS, and how families meet that challenge, and very successfully, for sure, all over the country, because it's not an easy road to take, but we have a lot of wonderful folks out there that have really taught me a lot, and I'm going to share some of that with you tonight. And then when family care isn't enough, what happens when we can't handle everything within our families, and perhaps we need to seek some support outside. And just reminding you of some of the resources that are available to you both within the Society and in terms of publications. So when we talk about progressive disease, we know that in terms of how we often describe MS, in terms of courses of MS, that three of the four courses of MS include the word progressive. So we have secondary progressive, which usually begins as relapsing remitting, of course, and then transitions into secondary progressive. We have primary progressive, and we have progressive relapsing. So obviously progressive is a feature of MS and something that many people dealing with MS do have to live with. Of course, when it's secondary progressive, that means that folks begin with that relapsing remitting course. So there were remissions and relapses, and then after a while those remissions get fewer and the disease steadily progresses. With primary progressive, of course, the disease progresses from the beginning, although sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly, without discrete attacks, but basically an unremitting course from the onset is how we tend to think of primary progressive. And usually it involves a higher incidence of spinal cord disease, so one is more apt to begin having difficulty walking if they have a primary progressive diagnosis. The progressive relapsing is relatively uncommon. Only about 5% of people with MS have progressive relapsing, and we describe that as kind of the disease is progressing from the beginning, but there are occasional relapses. And of course, because there are those relapses, folks might be eligible for some disease-modifying therapies because that's what usually is the entree into having disease-modifying therapies, is those relapses and remissions. You know, the journey to progression obviously differs. If you're transitioning from relapsing remitting, you probably took advantage of disease-modifying therapies. They were probably an option for you. And then as time went along, you know, you kind of go up and down with the disease. And for a long time, those remissions really keep alive the hope of kind of beating the disease, because you're kind of intensely dealing with symptoms. And then many times you go back to kind of a baseline, and it's almost like you didn't have that exacerbation. And there's always that hope, you know, maybe it won't come back, and of course, many times it does. And so when you do transition to a progressive course from that relapsing remitting course, it's often accompanied by kind of a sense of failure, almost like, I wasn't strong enough, I couldn't fight, I couldn't make it through. But actually, we know that progression is a feature of MS, so it doesn't really, you know, you can't stop it by anything you do. But I think a lot of people that reach that progression from a relapsing remitting course do have that sort of sense of disappointment and failure. When disease progression is there from the onset, of course, then most of the time the FDA-approved medications that address the disease course are not going to be of a benefit. They're certainly, most of the treatments out there are focused on relapsing remitting, which is very frustrating to those with progressive disease. And the reason for that is that in the relapsing remitting disease, the inflammatory process is really what's going on, and that's why one has kind of exacerbations and then a quieter time. And that's what these disease-modifying therapies target. Unfortunately, when you have a primary progressive course, it involves a lot of neurons that just don't respond to those anti-inflammatory therapies. And so there's really a dearth of treatments out there, and it becomes very difficult for some kinds of clinical trials to be done, because it's hard to measure changes. It's not as easy as kind of measuring when one is having an exacerbation and when one isn't. So for many people that have kind of had progressive disease from the beginning, they often think of themselves as orphans. It's like, you know, there's a lot of attention to MS, but it's just not for me. So it can be extremely frustrating. But, you know, so the journey to progression certainly varies depending on how you started that course. But the challenge of progression is really the same. We know that we're dealing with kind of a worsening of neurologic function, and, you know, few or no recovery or remission periods when the major symptoms abate, although there certainly can be plateaus. Symptoms, on the whole, need to be dealt with on a daily basis, and many times symptoms do lead to increasing disability. But that doesn't mean there's nothing that we can do, and we're going to talk about that tonight as we go a little bit further. Just thinking about the symptoms of MS, there's certainly a myriad of symptoms, and of course not everyone has all of these symptoms, and sometimes we have some symptoms for a period of time and then we move on and have another kind of symptom. So there's certainly the nature and severity of these symptoms vacillates. But I just wanted to make a few comments on the symptoms, just in terms of my own thoughts as I think about living with these, with MS and dealing with these symptoms on a daily basis. Balance is certainly one, and that when we're talking balance, we're really talking safety. And it's important to remember that we're not only talking standing balance, we're actually talking sitting balance as well. And so you always want to be on the outlook for a physical therapist or an occupational therapist who can help address this issue if you're dealing with it, because it can be a risky symptom. Bladder is certainly one that bladder issues are those that most people with MS do deal with, and certainly there's medications to address failure to store, and there's strategies like intermittent catheterization or indwelling catheters to address the failure to empty. So we have things that can be done, but we do want to make sure that people are seeking attention for that, because bladder issues, of course, can lead to infections, and you want to avoid that. So you certainly want to be talking with your doctor about that. Bowel management is certainly always a piece that we deal with, and most of the time that's managed through diet or bowel programs or stool softeners. Cognitive issues, you know, we didn't think cognitive issues were kind of really a very large part of MS for many years, but we've come to the conclusion that they definitely are. And we're not talking about intellect or any kind of dementia, but we're talking about kind of a short-term memory problem, sometimes just keeping up, attention span, it's often a good idea if one is beginning to sense some cognitive issues to get some neuropsychological testing and see what kind of cognitive rehab might be available. Depression, this is of course a result of the disease as well as and the process in the brain as well as the reaction to it. But depression responds to medications and it responds to therapy. So we always want to encourage people to get attention to this because if something can be done. Fatigue is always there. I think the best description I've heard of fatigue is a woman who said that she felt like a bicycle pump had been put onto her body and just sucks the air out. And I think that's a very powerful analogy, and I think many folks can really relate to that. And, of course, the fatigue is not related to exertion. But there are, again, there's medications, there's energy conservation strategies, there's cooling strategies. So, again, we don't want to ignore any of these symptoms. There's something that can be done for all of them. Pain, again, is one that, whether it's coming from the disease or coming from compensating for the disease, we need to address it. And in order to address pain, you really need to know the cause. So it's important to really identify why that pain is there so that we're sure that we're addressing in the right place. In terms of sensory issues, again, safety, if you have a numbness, if you can't feel, then you can hurt yourself. You can bump into something and not know it, of course, or burn yourself and not be aware. So sensory is another one that has a very high safety piece to it and something that we want to make sure we're checking ourselves. Sexuality, sexual dysfunction is a problem for many people with MS at every kind of a disease course. And, of course, it's impacted by fatigue or pain or spasticity. So, again, it's so important to identify the problem. Speech is an area that can sometimes be an issue. As well as swallowing, and this is where speech-language pathologists are wonderful. So if one is having any issues with speech or swallowing, it's really important to have those specialists evaluate and see what they can suggest that would make things work better. Spasticity, again, it impacts sleep and mobility and transfers and sexual functioning. There's certainly medications out there, but It is important to be balanced so that we're not kind of giving too much medication. It really does have to be kind of figured out as time goes along as to what's the best amount to have. And some of you may be aware of the baclofen pump, which is very popular in terms of a pump that can be put into the individual and kind of direct that medication directly into the spinal column. So it usually is quite efficient, and I know a lot of folks are using that and having good luck with it. And of course, with spasticity, you always want to be looking at the stretching and proper positioning and range of motion. Tremor is a tough one. It's a really hard symptoms to deal with. Certainly, occupational therapists are probably the most helpful at seeing what can be done to limit that as much as possible. And vision deficits, of course, is often associated with MS. And again, those specialists, that neuro-ophthalmologist, if one is having visual issues and the it has not been definitively diagnosed or there's been no specific attention to what can make it better, certainly a neuro-ophthalmologist should be seen. And of course, there's many assistive vision devices that are important. And then weakness, and we know that impacts body strength and mobility. And again, physical therapy, occupational therapy, these are the interventions that can really help to address those issues. So when it comes to clinically managing the disease and all these symptoms, I think the first thing that's important is to have the right neurologist. And by that I mean someone that you can really trust, that you can really talk to and communicate. You know a lot about your MS, and so you need to be a very active partner in managing the disease. And so you want to be working with a doctor who respects your input and that you can work together and problem solve together. And it's also very important to be educated about MS and all the different strategies for dealing with the symptoms. The better informed we are, the better decisions we make. So we really want to keep up with the latest. We want to go to educational programs when you can. Read Momentum magazine when it arrives at your door. Use the society or other reliable websites, and just stay informed, because it's going to help you deal with your disease in a much more knowledgeable and effective way. Certainly also we need to have both specialized care and we need to have primary health care. One needs to kind of build a team of healthcare professionals that have experience in serving people with MS and really understand the disease. And that involves nurses and physician assistants and rehabilitation professionals. We really need to make sure social workers, case managers, urologists, whoever is serving you should have some expertise about MS. And if you don't think they do, have them call the society and have them build up their knowledge, because it's going to make a difference in the long run. But at the same time, we need to keep focused on our primary health care. It's so easy to get focused on our MS, because that's where what's taking a lot of our attention. But of course, we are susceptible to all the other health issues that people can face. So we want to make sure that you're getting all of the kinds of preventive tests and so on that's needed, and make sure that you're monitoring your cholesterol and et cetera, so that you're doing all you can to keep yourself as healthy as possible, and certainly preventing unnecessary complications. We know that with MS, I was mentioning bladder infections earlier, certainly pressure sores if one is not able to be too mobile, sometimes aspiration pneumonia if one's having trouble with swallowing or respiration, osteoporosis because of the use of steroids, sometimes more higher risk for that, and contractures that are left untreated can really cause issues. So you want to be very vigilant in terms of keeping an eye on what's happening and seeking attention if you sense that there's anything wrong. And, you know, engaging in wellness activities is so important. Wellness focuses on what one can do, you know, not what one cannot do. And the goal is to have a healthy balance of body and mind and spirit. So people need exercise and aquatics and yoga or Tai Chi or good nutrition, meditation, expressive activities, outings in the community, involvement in and spiritual communities. All of those areas really nurture all of our body and our soul and our mind, and we need to keep engaged in those activities. And certainly when it comes to clinically managing the disease, one does need to understand their insurance rights and protections, and that's kind of an awesome thing to say because I know it's very difficult. It's so complicated, but particularly now with the healthcare reform legislation that's been passed by Congress, it's really important to keep informed as to what's out there. What are your rights? Particularly now, there's a lot out there to help people be able to change employers and change insurers and not be taken off because of a lot of claims. So it's important that one knows all of those options, and particularly if you're on Medicare. There's a Medicare Rights Center. There's a Center for Medicare Advocacy. These are organizations that are out there to make sure that people are getting the care that they deserve. So be very vigilant on that, all the way from choosing the right plan to making sure that you're getting everything that you are entitled to. When we look at emotional issues, certainly fear of the unknown is a huge one. There's a lot of apprehension about the future and you know, what part of my body might not function as it has. How will I continue to get help I need if that's true? I remember one young man saying to me, I never know what's going to visit me in the night. So it is. It's a very fearful and it causes a lot of concern because there's no given answers. No one can predict, and that's a very hard thing to live with. And of course, every change and every symptom can represent a new loss, and it can be very wearying, just constantly dealing with new challenges to daily living. Feeling sad and angry and frustrated is very understandable, and the challenge is to try to channel those emotions, particularly anger, so that it doesn't get displaced onto those around us that any more than necessary. It's really hard because when you have a lot of anger and you have no great place to put it, it builds up and it's very difficult. That leads to kind of that feeling of not being in control, and that's not a feeling anyone wants to have. One does need to stay very alert to the emotional and cognitive changes they might be experiencing as well as physical ones. You really want to be in touch with what's going on. And certainly as one might become more dependent on others, have less autonomy, again, that's hard because you're less able to do things on your own timetable. We had a focus group of people with primary progressive MS, and they were describing what a good day was and what a bad day was. And for a good day, they said, those are the days when I'm not experiencing major symptoms, I'm feeling energized without pain or stress, I can think more clearly, I'm able to participate in normal activities, and just enjoy simply being alive and loved. And a bad day, they said, I focus on the symptoms, I feel more isolated, it's hard to find something to look forward to. So how do we address that? How do we even begin to deal with those very challenging emotions? Well, I think the first thing is to acknowledge and talk about the challenges with others who understand. And that's where I think the society can be wonderful because you can get connected to people that are truly experiencing what you're experiencing, whether it's just meeting someone at a meeting or being in a self-help group. There's a saying, sitting on the morning bench, and it just means, just sit with me. Just understand what I'm going through. You don't even have to say anything, but it's so reassuring to know someone's there with me. And I think that seeking out those opportunities is really important. And then I guess one does need to try to redefine control and independence, looking for new ways to feel in control. So that usually means finding ways to do things differently from before, but hopefully being able to do them. And probably the best piece to help us with that is assistive technology, because that often can give back a lot of a sense of control and independence, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. We also need to kind of redefine the self and find and and nurture an MS-free zone, as we like to talk about it. People with MS are way beyond, their identity and their selves are way beyond just that disease. Their parents and grandparents and friends and readers and movie lovers and music lovers and cheerleaders, storytellers, advocates, good listeners. There's so many things that we are beyond a disease, and we need to keep in touch with all those parts of ourselves. So an MS-free zone is kind of where that disease cannot reach, and it's kind of an emotional respite from MS and its day-to-day challenges. It's a chance to refuel. And I think also one needs to renegotiate the goals and priorities sometimes and just kind of see if one can gain satisfaction from new skills or new plans or new goals. Of course, this is easier said than done. I always remember a quote by Richard Cohen, whom you might have heard of. He has MS. He's married to Meredith Vieira, who's on NBC, I think. And Richard has written a couple of books, and I always remembered one of his quotes. He said, "I want to believe that teaching children about history and music and showing grace and humor in the face of adversity means more than driving a car. Those who love us see past the problems. Who we are stands not in our sneakers, but in our souls." And I think that's a really, really powerful statement. And I really respect him for sharing that, because I know it's been a very, very challenging course for him. And certainly we need to balance the need for safety with the need of independence. And this is always tough. You know, sometimes people don't want to, let's say, move to another level of technology. Let's say move from a walker to a wheelchair, or from a manual chair to a power chair, because they feel they're giving into the disease. But on the other hand, many times accepting that enables them to do things more easily and more safely. So it's a balancing act. There's certainly no right or wrong, but it's kind of trying to find that place where people can be at peace with whatever they might feel they need in order to keep going. And planning for the future is so important, and this is something, place where we can have some control, because if we can anticipate anything that might come along in the future, prepare for possibilities. They may not happen, but if you have the conversation of what will happen if, and then you think about that and you figure out how you're going to deal with that, that's a great way to avoid crises, and it really does give control, because there's a plan. So whether or not it's needed, one knows how one's going to deal with it, what kind of help is out there. Then we kind of talk about family issues a little bit. You know, each family member copes in his or her own way. So we have different coping styles. Some people like to talk about the problems, and some people don't want to talk at all. Some people want to learn everything they possibly can learn about an issue, and another one will say, you know what, I just want to live day to day. I don't want to look at anything beyond that. Some people like to share with other people and involve them in their issues. Other people say, no, we need to deal with this as a family. Sometimes family members want to seek outside support. Other family members might say, look, we can handle this on our own. And this just reflects coping styles, how we all kind of adjust to different changes and challenges that we each face. And so there needs to be a recognition, of course, that within the family, just because we're one family, everyone isn't going to agree. So we need to kind of keep this in mind and try to understand each other so we can see where everyone is coming from. And then there's that making space for MS without giving it more than it needs. One of my colleagues, Roz Cal, likes to talk about MS as the uninvited guest. Moves in, takes over space in every room, and doesn't go home. And it is a chronic illness, and it does reduce freedom and spontaneity. And families often feel like they live in an on-call state. You just kind of never know what's going to happen. But these are all realities. But the more one can kind of find that space as a family that doesn't get taken over by MS, the more helpful certainly it is. And certainly trying to share family resources equally. MS is greedy. So every family balances demands in terms of time and energy and financial resources, and families are challenged to incorporate MS without becoming so focused on it that they have limited resources to devote elsewhere. So it does take a lot of work, emotional work, communication, working these things through. And certainly, progressive MS can impact the roles within a family. You know, families are mini systems, we all have our roles as to what we do and when, and it's kind of a rhythm of how things get accomplished. And when these roles and responsibilities require change, it can be very unsettling. And many times, of course, how roles were allocated in the past will impact how disruptive something was. Obviously, if a person with MS used to cook all the meals and always be home and picked up all the children from school, and now they're not able to carry that out, obviously that's going to have an impact on what everyone else does. And families have cycles, too. I mean, you sometimes have little children, then you might have teenagers. You might be very well connected with your neighborhood, or you might have just moved in. All of these things can impact the resources and how we can redistribute and get things done, even if someone dealing with MS may not be able to carry on exactly what they have done before. And certainly a family issue is finances. MS is an expensive disease. It often reduces income. And yet there's a lot of other responsibilities there that have to be cared for out there, like mortgages and college and home repairs and weddings. So there's no question that a very major family issue is in terms of dollars. So how do we address family issues? Well, I think we build on the family strength and resourcefulness. All families have had to deal with crises and setbacks, and those families bring coping skills to the table. The strengths are already there. So I think it's important to realize that one is not starting from a place of zero here. We've accumulated certain experiences in our lifetime, and this is going to help us to get through dealing with this as well. Probably the pivotal thing is open communication and really respecting each family member's needs. It's each person in the family needs to be heard and understood. How is MS affecting them? What are their goals? What can they contribute to the family? What can't they contribute? For how long? You might be having a teenager or an adult child that's going to be moving out. We need to be talking with them to see what their concerns and fears are. And children, they need to be involved. The message should just be, you know what, look, this is challenging, but we're going to deal with this, and we're going to deal with this together. And this is particularly important communication when it comes to invisible symptoms, because it's hard if somebody can't see what is dealing with to really kind of grasp what a person is going through. So communication is so pivotal within the family. And problem solving. Problem solving together about how things are going to get done. Living with chronic illness is a process, and you need to work together on solutions. So you try to make new plans, and you try to engage in new activities. And certainly one does need to try to build flexibility into the lifestyle. Renegotiation, reevaluating tasks and assignments, and what is each family member good at, and how can we pick up and get things done as a unit? What do we have now, and what do we need to create? And we can't forget that fun and doing things that replenish and restore us is a very important part of that process. We need to keep our souls restored and ready for the next day. I often think of a story about a competition between a young man and an older gentleman in terms of how many trees they were going to cut down at this logging camp. And they started out at the same time, and the young man was just way ahead of the older man. And then after a while, after each tree, the older man would go behind a little cottage, and then he'd come back in a few minutes and start the next tree. And at the end, the man that had gone back to behind the cottage between every tree actually got the most trees down in the period of time. And the younger man came up and said, well, how did you do that? What were you doing when you left here? And he said, well, I was sharpening my blade. And I think that's what we have to do, too, as individuals and as families. We have to find those those ways to sharpen our blades so we can go forward. And we need to widen our network of support. Particularly, we think of this with caregivers. Sometimes family members don't think of themselves as a caregiver. They think of themselves as a family member who's helping a loved one. But sometimes identifying as a caregiver is a way to get access to some support and services out there. So we want to make sure we're getting everything that can help us. And certainly with finances, we strongly recommend that families really have some good discussions with their accountants or some kind of financial planner. There's a lot of things that can be done in terms of tax deductions and maximizing insurance and government benefits and Medicaid waiver programs, and it's just important to be sure that we're smart in terms of how we protect assets and also maximize eligibility for services. So when you look at how families kind of cope with living with a progressive MS, I think there's probably four major factors that really contribute significantly to how families are going to do. One is certainly getting quality medical care for that person with MS. That has got to be a primary priority. And we want to keep as strong and healthy as possible. So that's very critical, and it's always central. Accessibility is going to be a big determinant of how one can go on regardless of where the course of the disease goes. And that means having accessible homes that are safe, whether it's ramps or roll-in showers or modified kitchens, grab bars. We often say reorganize, refit, renovate. But the home needs to be a safe place, and it also needs to be a place that can be an avenue to moving out into the community so you're not a prisoner in your own home, so to speak. And certainly the community needs accessibility as well. We're very fortunate that we've had the ADA in our country, and so it has affected what's out there in terms of accessibility in communities and paratransit for transportation. But they're not what they should be, and that's a role that you can really help to play, is to bring attention to where your community is not helping those with disabilities be able to be fully integrated in community life. Assistive equipment and technology is really the avenue to independence, to conserving energy, to being able to carry out activities of daily living and just move around effectively and safely and comfortably. Scooters are popular, and they are fine as long as you're able to transfer independently and have some trunk strength. But power chairs also enable people to get out and around and can be very, very helpful and really give more support if that's needed. Lifts can help, of course, tracking systems sometimes. There's environmental control units now where, of course, where you can have these little machines that can turn on a light or turn on the TV. All of these things help to make one more independent and be able to continue to do what one wants to do. And then finally, personal assistance. And certainly many, many families and friends and volunteers are helping folks that do need more assistance so that they can continue to be up and get around and do what they want to do. So, and that often depends, too, on your support network is going to depend on whether you live alone, whether you have a lot of relatives, just where the family cycle is in terms of children and retired and elderly parents, all of that. But personal assistance is usually critical. So these are the four ways to kind of remain active and engaged: good care, accessibility, assistive equipment and technology, and personal assistance. But sometimes it does come to the point where the family just can't do it all, and they really need to look to more help from outside, and that's when long-term care services come into play. And it's really important to realize that long-term care is not nursing home care only. A lot of people think it is, but it's not. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's really a range of services to help people who require hands-on assistance to maintain functioning and independence. So it takes place all over, in the home, adult day programs, supportive housing, assisted living, nursing homes. There's a whole range. And usually we think of people needing long-term care services if they need assistance with some activities of daily living in order to maintain their health and be as independent as possible. So if someone needs assistance in doing whether it's walking, bathing, dressing, toileting, grooming, transfers, eating, all of those things. When one needs assistance, then we often think of them requiring long-term care services. And there's also what we often call instrumental activities of daily living, and those are things like meal preparation and laundry and grocery shopping and managing finances and medication management. And it's usually when we're needing those kinds of supports that we think of needing some kind of long-term care assistance. And, of course, the biggest issue is that so many of those services are housed within elderly-focused programs, and that's very hard. When people with MS that require long-term care services are usually younger. They have more disability, but they're more cognitively intact. They have more ties to the community, and they really need more unique programs, and not the same programs that 80 and 90-year-olds. Need. So this is an area that is a big concern. It's certainly been an area that I've spent a lot of my time at the Society working on, and we need to get more of those options out there. So just to quickly run down, in the home and community-based services, there's so many services that can be brought into the home, certainly personal care and home health care, but homemakers, companions, telephone reassurance, care management, all of those things that can help one to be able to remain at home. And the good news is that this is becoming a preference not only of people needing long-term care services, because certainly it's a preference for those who need the support, but it's also becoming a preference for the federal and state governments who pay the bill. So we're seeing increasingly more dollars put to helping people stay in their own homes, and this is really terrific news. I remember when I was in the chapter many years ago, people used to go into a nursing home and they would say, if I just had the money they're going to spend in the nursing home and I could spend it at home, I wouldn't have to go there. And I think finally our society is getting to the point where they're realizing that that is where they need to be. So that's the good news. It's going to be more and more resources going to helping people that need long-term care services remain at home. When that's not possible, there's certainly other venues that are available. Adult day programs is a great one, because it provides a place where people can go and meet other people and get involved with activities and exercise and rehab, and gives them a break from the family and the family a break from them. It's a wonderful thing. The problem is, of course, most of the adult day programs out there are elderly focused, and most people with MS that are younger don't want to exactly go and sit with a lot of elderly folks. But we are getting more and more providers out there that are looking at having programs for younger people, and I think, again, that's going to be really good news. It's for people that are living at home, but it just adds another dimension and connection for them. Supportive housing is also on that realm of continuum of care, and this is accessible, affordable apartments, group homes. Most of the time, these involve sharing services and perhaps meals or some personal assistance. We're beginning to really look at the housing needs of people with MS. We're actually going to be doing a very big study from our research department, and that'll be wonderful because then we'll be able to tell exactly what the housing issues are. And once we know that, we'll be able to go out there and address it and advocate for meeting the needs more effectively. There is a new tool that's on websites of the chapters I just want to mention called Accessible Affordable Housing, a guide for people with MS, and it really covers housing all the way from remaining in your own home, buying a home, rentals, contracting to get modifications made, all the way through rental assistance and subsidized housing. So if you have any questions on housing across the whole continuum of housing, check your chapter website out and see if they can give you some leads as to contacts within your community that can help. And then, of course, assisted living is out there. It's a really viable option because it includes support services and meals and some health-related services, and yet it's very independence focused. Probably affordability is the biggest issue when it comes to assisted living, but I think what people have to be careful to do is to just make sure they're totally comparing, because when you look at the costs of being at home versus assisted living, you need to when you're looking at your home costs, you need to include things like food and insurance and utilities and taxes and home maintenance, and make sure that that's totally being factored into your cost of being at home compared to the assisted living. And sometimes it helps people to see that maybe it's not such an impossible option after all. And then, of course, nursing homes, and this is where one can receive 24-hour skilled care. They can manage very complex clinical needs. They have a medical director on staff. And the good news about nursing homes is that there is an increasing emphasis on what is called the culture change movement. So nursing homes are becoming much less rigid, much more flexible, much more consumer-directed. And we do have several homes now across the country that have communities for people with MS, and we're working to get that even more expanded so that if nursing home care is required, again, a person with MS doesn't have to think about going and sitting in a nursing home with a lot of frail elders. We really want them to have a community where they can stay active and engaged. In terms of what the society does, I guess perhaps you have heard that as we look ahead to the next 3-4 years, progressive MS is going to be a very major focus of our work in everything that we do, whether it's research or whether it's services, whether it's education. It's really going to be a center point, and so I'm hopeful that this is going to be a very welcome change for those that have had a progressive course of the disease and have just felt that there wasn't much out there for them. We hope to really change that. There's going to be a lot of emphasis in research and trying to find answers that we have not found yet in terms of progression, a lot of education of providers, a lot of long-term care advocacy. And that's, again, where you can do a lot as far as putting a face on the disease and getting out there and letting politicians and policymakers understand what it's like living with a chronic progressive disease and the kinds of services you need. And certainly the society will continue to work with families and make sure that they have the information and the support and options for recreation and wellness and care management services, all those things that can really help to make it easier. Just in closing, there are some resources that for progressive MS that you would certainly want to know about. There is a book. It's entitled Primary Progressive Multiple Sclerosis, What You Need to Know, but anyone living with a progressive course of the disease could certainly appreciate reading this book. And in addition to talking about the disease and the various strategies for managing it, there's also a DVD, and it includes people with, in this case, primary progressive disease, and it's a really informative DVD. I think you'd get a lot out of it. And as was mentioned earlier, you know, there's this book, Caring for Loved Ones with Advanced MS, A Guide for Families. This was written with people with MS and family members on the team, and the feedback we get is that it's really been a helpful resource, so I would urge you to get a copy. And also our website. We now have a special landing page for more progressive disease so that you can go in and get to some materials that's really relevant to you. So I think I'm going to stop there. I know this has been a really quick run through, but what I thought I would do is kind of try to highlight some of these issues, and then I would hope that if there's certain areas that you would really like more time spent, that you would talk with your chapters and perhaps they can set up some future calls and get into more depth in some of these areas. But I think with this, I'm going to turn it back to Heather, I think, and we'll see if there's any questions out there.
Thank you so much, Dorothy. We'll wait and see and get the questions lined up.
Sounds good.
If you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, if you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We have a question from the line of Anne.
Thank you very much. I live in St. Louis, mm-hmm. and I have no car. I'm in housing. And I've lost 3/4 of my hair. It came out in clumps. I'm in relaxing remission. I'm taking Baclofen 3 times a day. I'm taking Solumetrol once a month, 2 days in a row. I do burn myself My hands are cut. I have no feeling in my fingertips, so I have such cramps that you can't straighten your hands out or your feet out.
Mm-hmm.
So I also don't have family here. My sister lives in Florida. My other family lives in New York. They are sickly themselves. I can't move to them. My friends, I lost 14 friends in a period of 17 months, so I have no one. I'm in housing, so I'm quite alone in a small apartment, and I don't have a car, so I can't go to meetings. I can't run out to the MS Center and say, oh, I can socialize.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I can remember the past so vividly, but moment to moment, I have difficulty. I have visual problems also. My slurring has gotten better. In the morning, it used to be there, nobody understood me.
Are you in the hands of a good neurologist, Dan? I mean, do you see someone that you trust that you feel is doing all that they can for you?
I really don't know, because he just is so gentle and talks and goes, well, we'll try this, and this is MS, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't go further with mm-hmm. me. And as far as when I was married and divorced now, I had no sexual feeling whatsoever. And at that time, he had samples of different products for men that are now for women, and I had no sensation whatsoever.
Are you in connection with the chapter at all?
I am on the mm-hmm. phone, but mm-hmm. you have to get out there. They used to have transportation.
Right.
But because of money, lack of money,
mm-hmm.
they cannot pick me up and take me there. For me to get there, I have a walker with wheels, a wheelchair, but I have to carry the wheelchair onto a bus and take about three buses, which would take me 3 hours
mm-hmm.
to get there,
mm-hmm.
and then 3 hours to get back home.
You know, do you have a specific question? Because what my thought is, as I listen to you, is, you know, it sounds like you could really benefit from talking with a care manager that I think most of the chapters have, a kind of a core of those folks, and they are really there to kind of help you see where, you know, what your needs are medically and in terms of services and making sure you're accessing every possible benefit that's there for you.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like, you know, you're real, this is not the way you want to go on and live, you know, day after day after day for sure.
Yeah.
And so you need to see some, you know, you need to see some brighter horizons out there. And I would really, really strongly suggest that you be in contact with the chapter and ask if they would have a care manager that you could speak with. Because they are the pros in terms of knowing how to link people to the programs and benefits and entitlements that are out there. And I would just hope to, you know, hate to think that you are not accessing everything that you should have. And you might need another opinion on your MS as well. Maybe go to a specialist for at least a second opinion to make sure you're capitalizing on everything that's there. So I would urge you to call the chapter and see if they have care managers available and if it would be possible for you to link up with one and see if your life situation can be made better.
And I have also the bladder. I have DEAP that I'm taking. It's the last drug that I can take without going to self-catheterization.
Right.
And it's working, but I'm very restless. I'm in cramps all the time, and I have no one to talk to. I mean, no one understands MS in this building. I mean, what is MS? You can explain it a thousand different
right,
ways.
Right, I know. Well, that's why I was saying it. It does mean a lot to connect with people who can share, that. But I would really strongly, I know I have to take some more calls, but I would really strongly suggest you check with the chapter and see if they can get someone that could really take a full picture of your situation and see if there's something else that could be brought in here that's going to make your life better.
Well, my Medicare,
and
I have a regular...
I apologize. I do think
I'm
we should
sorry.
Move on. I'm
Thank
sorry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Kelly.
Yes, I'm wondering if you could touch on how you determine whether you need to switch doctors, if there's any information out there on determining that.
Well, I'll tell you, I know that there's a periodical out there about choosing a healthcare professional that would probably be on the website, and the chapter would probably have a copy of it. So I would suggest you take that because there's some good pointers there. I you know, it is a very good question. It's probably not a very specific right or wrong answer. But I do think, you know, MS is something that really does require a partnership between the person with MS and the doctor. And you want a couple of things. One, you want a doctor that you really trust, understands MS, and knows MS. Now, there's many neurologists out there that are wonderful neurologists, but they may not have had a lot of experience serving people with MS. And certainly the goal would be to try to find a doctor that has some expertise in MS, but also kind of sees that patient provider partnership is how you determine how you're going to go forward. This, you know, MS is a science in some ways in terms of treating it. It's also an art, and you kind of need to have a very global view. You want someone who really has a more holistic view and really is looking not only at the medical condition, but all the other things that, comprise our lives. So, certainly, comfort level is important, expertise is important, and even a second opinion to start that way isn't a bad idea. Do you have a particular concern about your doctor?
I have a wonderful doctor, but at some point I think, you know, the disease will progress enough mm-hmm. that I do need to seek a professional or someone who's very familiar with the MS. I know that mine usually does a little of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, he's a wonderful guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not ready to move on, but, you know, mm-hmm. it's how do you determine when it's time to move
right.
on?
Right. And perhaps one thing would be to go for a second opinion with many of our specialists in MS see folks as a second opinion, you know, that they want to stay with their doctors, but they just want to make sure that they're, you know, accessing all the up-to-date treatments and that, you know, they're doing all that they possibly can to make sure that they're managing their disease. So you might start that way. You're not particularly changing a doctor, but if you have some concerns and you're not sure that your doctor has that specific expertise, then you might want to just go visit one of the specialists and at least have a kind of a, you know, an assessment made and see whether you're hearing from them something you don't hear from your own doctor that would be a concern.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Your next question comes from the line of Arlene.
Yes, hi. My name is Arlene Parker, and I have the pump and spasticity problem. I have all the symptoms that you went A to Z.
Ah.
But doctors have said I have a very strange, I puzzled five neurologists. Very strange case of MS, but they came up with no other disease. So how and when would I determine if I need a pump for spasticity? And which doctor would I go to, my neurologist?
Well, you would usually start with your neurologist, sometimes it depends. I think different disciplines do get involved. I don't know if you've I think between the neurologist and an MS nurse, if you have access to someone who really understands MS from the nursing perspective, and rehab also, rehabilitation specialists know pretty much about these pumps as well. It's certainly something you should explore if you haven't. Only in the sense that, you know, it may not be for everyone, of course, so you always have to get your medical advice. But it seems to be a strategy that really people have found very freeing, that, you know, and you don't have that over, you know, it keeps that medicine very targeted so that you don't have some of the side effects that you might have from oral medications. If you look up, probably our website has information about it, and what you might want, it's called a baclofen pump, and you may want to, you know, copy it off and bring it to your doctor.
Okay.
And say, you know, would this work for me? You know, do you think that this is something that I should think about?
Okay, no access to the computer. and
I'm sure your chapter can get that information. You call the chapter and you say, could you print out and send to me some information on the baclofen pump, and then take it to your doctor and have a conversation and see if your physician thinks that this might be something that you might want to think about.
Okay. Would it coincide with getting Botox for spasms in my back?
Well, that would be another, Botox is another way to address, similar issues. So you'd need to talk about, what would it be an either or is there any problem with having both? I wouldn't assume I know that. I'm not a physician, but it's a good question. And you'd certainly want to make sure that the physician understands everything you're doing at this point to address spasticity, and then see if this might be another thing to try.
Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from the line of Nicole.
Hello?
Nicole?
Hi, can you hear me?
I sure can.
Hi, thanks for the chat, or seminar, rather. I'm buzzed in to say I've been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1988,
mm-hmm.
and my neurologist indicated to me that it'll pretty much be relapse or remitting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the past 5 years ago or so, I was told that relapse and remitting can go into progressive.
Right.
Is that the case?
Yes, and it actually is the case. What we know is that usually after about 10 years, half of the people that have relapsing remitting will go into a more progressive course. Now, of course, it varies. It may be a very, slow, more plateaued kind of course. But I guess bottom line, you would say that after a relapse, you don't go right back all the way to where you were before. You feel things kind of staying with you, a leg that doesn't move as well, and you begin to see that. And and if that's happening, then you probably are what we call transitioning into a more progressive course. And that is kind of what, most folks, I think by the time of 25 years with the disease, I think really the majority of folks will move to some form of progression. Now, that doesn't mean it has to be something really significant that's seriously impacting their life, but they do see that they're not coming back quite the way they used to.
So my doctor's being optimistic, in other words.
Say that again, dear?
So, in other words, you're saying my doctor's being just optimistic.
Well, I don't know, because it really, if you're beginning to kind of have more disability as you go along and you can feel that symptoms aren't going away, then you probably are beginning to transition to a little bit more progressive course. I couldn't say because, of course, I don't know. You'd need to talk to your doctor about that, but it might be a good question to ask. And say, I think you thought I was going to deal with relapsing remitting, but I'm beginning to think that I'm beginning to see some progression here. Is that possible? And have that conversation so you can really, get his that physician's point of view as to where he sees you and how you might do something a little differently now than you might have done before. Maybe be a little more aggressive on symptom management.
Well, so far he's right. I've not progressed as to where I don't relapse and then not come back.
Mm-hmm.
I've always come back. I always look like I look so good.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right.
But still though. And my husband's listening too.
Right.
Okay,
right. Well, that's a typical course. And of course, 85% of people with MS start with relapsing remitting. So that's the most common that we have.
Okay.
And so I wish you well.
Thank you.
Okay, your next question comes from the line of AJ.
And I think, everyone, this will be our last question this evening.
AJ, your line's open.
I'm sorry.
Okay, AJ?
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi. How often would you say depression tends to happen?
I'm having a little problem hearing you. Can you repeat that for me?
How often do you think depression happens?
Heather, did you understand that? I think.
Yes, I believe AJ asked how often depression happens.
Ah, okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. Well, it's a very common symptom in MS. I think I can't remember all the exact percentages, but at least half of people with MS have a significant clinical depressive episode at some point in dealing with the disease. So, and the reason it's so common in MS is that, as I mentioned, not only, you know, you're not dealing with an easy life, so naturally, you know, you get depressed just by things that you're having to deal with, but also, you know, MS is a disease of the brain, and so depression, when there's some damage in the brain, it can impact our emotions as well. So it's kind of a double whammy there, and so it's very, very common. I think the important message to hear is that that we are really pretty successful in working with depression if folks can get the medication that they need and if they can get into some psychotherapy. It's either or both have been very, very effective in dealing with depression. So if you are struggling with that, I'd strongly recommend to you to talk to your doctor and get these interventions, and I think you will definitely feel much better.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for your good questions this evening. This concludes our program. I would like to thank everyone on the line for joining us tonight, and also a big thank you to Dorothy Northrup for presenting on the topic of progressive MS this evening. Thank you very, very much, Dorothy.
You're so welcome.
Our program sponsors, Bayer Healthcare and Biogen IDEC, provided limited sponsorship of our educational teleconference series, and we appreciate their support. If you have further questions, as Dorothy mentioned, please don't hesitate to contact your local chapter. The phone number is 1-800-344-4867. At this time, all participants are invited to remain on the line and give their responses to three short survey questions. I hope you all have a wonderful evening. Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, please stand by. The polling session is about to begin. Question number one. Ladies and gentlemen, we have reached the polling session of the conference call. And to answer each question, you will need to press the corresponding number on your telephone keypad. Again, question one. I learned something that I will use in my day-to-day life. Press one for yes and two for no. We'll pause for just a moment. Question two. The content was presented clearly and in an unbiased way. Press 1 for yes and 2 for no. Question 3. The speaker was knowledgeable about the topic. Press 1 for yes and press 2 for no. Again, the speaker was knowledgeable about the topic. Press 1 for yes and 2 for no. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.